This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, and I'm the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am here to be the managing partner of your life. And with me to manage your life is none other than Carrie Kasem.
And your Instagram. I'm managing. You said manage your life, and then managing your Instagram.
I'm looking at you like, what are you talking about?
I just put something up on our Instagram.
That's the first time you've actually silenced me. I don't think in 5 years that I've ever just stood there.
Even though I just filmed you for it.
You just filmed me for Instagram. Yes. That's right. I'm managing the Instagram and the Facebook and the Twitter. Check us out on all of social media. We've got a really great show today. This is one of Carrie's favorite shows. I know that because she is a legal eagle and loves these legal shows.
Bring it on, Alan.
Bring it on. And we have our better halves sitting here. I guess, since we've been doing the show on Sunday, Nancy and Nico, they come and join us because no one has anything to do, so they hang out.
Yeah, it's a family show.
The kids are here, but they're not going to be on the mic because they are watching some kind of cartoon. Nancy, what are they watching?
Teen Titans.
Wow. They're getting old. They used to be watching like little baby videos, and now they're watching Teen Titans, whatever that might be.
Is Barney still good? Is he out? No, he's way out.
No, they're above that. But they've had a lot of fun. We had a weekend, me and the kids. Nancy was out of town at a bachelorette, so it was fun.
She went glamping, she told us.
What's that?
It's where you're kind of camping, but not really. Here, you have to grab a mic.
Oh, she doesn't have a mic. She's just smiling.
Now she has one.
Yes, it was a wild bachelorette party in the safari of Santa Rosa.
Wow, that sounds like fun. She sent pictures for the kids to see of giraffes and elephants and monkeys and pandas.
In the safari of Santa Rosa.
Just wanted to see if you're listening. All right, we're getting off topic because we've got a lot of stuff to cover. Thanks for being here, Nico, Nancy. Wayman, Renee.
The kids.
The kids is outside. They're not even in here. Maybe we'll have them on later at the end of the show. By the way, halfway through the show, we do have a really interesting guest because we have two really interesting guests today. Lot to learn. Chase Bowden is going to join us on the half hour. If you don't know about Chase, a really interesting guy. He's a candidate for San Francisco's district attorney 2019 election. And what's interesting about him is when he was very young, like 14 months, his parents were both put in jail. They were members of the radical leftist group, Black Liberation Army and Weather Underground. And they were sentenced to decades in prison for their role in an armed robbery that left three dead, including two police officers. And Chase ended up going to Yale Law School, is a public defender, and he is challenging some of the candidates. Susie Loftus is one of the favorites. She's endorsed by Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris. And Chase is chasing them, the others, to see if he can get that DA seat from George Gascon. So you're going to want to hear the story. It's a really incredible story, how he grew up with his parents in jail and what he learned from visiting jail and prison, actually, and his platform in the San Francisco district attorney's election. Before we get to Chesa, we have Professor John Eastman, and he probably has a different perspective than Chase. I don't think he had the same background as Chase did, and his perspective on the law, I think, is a little bit different than what we're going to hear from Chase. And it would have been really nice to have kind of a debate between the two of them, because Professor Eastman is a great debater. He's debated Erwin Chemerinsky on our show before, and today he's just going to talk about the Supreme Court decisions that they have just finished their term. Professor John Eastman is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law at Dale E. Fowler School of Law, and he was the school dean from 2007 to 2010, and then he stepped down to run for the California Attorney General position. He was a law clerk for Clarence Thomas. Professor John Eastman, welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Thanks for having me back on the program, and a very good week to do it with the Supreme Court just concluding its term.
Absolutely. Yes. I know Carrie gets excited about it because...
I do, because you agree with me on a lot of things, especially when Erwin Chemerinsky's on, and I have both Alan and Erwin that take an opposing viewpoint, and then I have you on, and it's like, wait, you agree with me? This is wonderful. So it's great to have you back on.
Professor Eastman, before we run through, and we're going to do the rapid round because we want to run over about six or seven cases that came down, session is closed. Before we get to some of those cases, I do want to ask you your perspective on the session that just ended and what the impact of Brett Kavanaugh has been on the Supreme Court. Now, we know that he voted 94% of the time with Chief Justice Roberts and 91% with Samuel Alito, which is a little bit different from Neil Gorsuch, who was mostly with your former boss, I would say, Clarence Thomas. Tell us your perspective of Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court this term.
Well, I think what happened bears out what I thought was going to happen, which is Brett Kavanaugh is a little bit further to the right than his former boss, Anthony Kennedy, was. But we now have, again, a court that's four solid liberals, three fairly solid conservatives, and two people in the middle, Roberts and Kavanaugh, who lean toward the right, but not consistently. They are certainly more to the right than the last time we had those kind of two center swing votes in O'Connor and Kennedy. But you know, you'll see some cases, for example, the census case we'll talk about in a minute, where John Roberts joins with the liberals in, you know, in kind of a incomprehensible opinion, in my view.
Right.
And so it looks like they're playing a little bit of politics in the center of the court, trying to negotiate things rather than just taking the law where it leads.
And I think that's something that probably will take place next year and maybe even more so. You mentioned the census case, Department of Commerce versus New York. That's kind of the sexy case, at least for the last few cases, because I think by all accounts, there hasn't been any real cases that have stood out that people are talking about, that people are watching very closely. But the census case is one that has a lot of people thinking. And tell us your take on that. You mentioned Chief Justice Roberts and kind of an incomprehensible decision. I kind of agree with you there. I'm not sure what he was thinking, but he certainly looks like he punted a little bit on the real issue here. But let's talk about it. This is the case where the question comes up that Trump wanted on the census regarding citizenship. And it's the census in 2020, a question regarding citizenship. Tell us what happened.
Well, and let me first back up a step, because a lot of the major media have been talking about Trump wanted to add a citizenship question. What he and Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross wanted to do is restore a census question. It'd been on every census since 1820, save for one, all the way up until 2000. The first census that didn't have it, either on the long form or the short form, was 2010 during the Obama administration. So we're simply going back to what had been the historic norm. And here's where the opinion gets puzzling. Roberts writes the opinion for the majority, 5-4 majority, split along ideological lines with Roberts joining the liberals on the court. And he says, one, the Constitution allows for us to ask a citizenship question. Two, the statute allows the Secretary of Commerce to decide to add that question. Three, the reason he gave, because it will enhance our voting rights litigation in the Department of Justice, is a perfectly valid reason. but we really don't believe that was your real reason, and so we're going to strike down your effort to add the census question, or citizenship question, and send it back to you. Now, to send it back is where the next play is going to be, and we'll see what the Department of Justice, the Department of Commerce, and the president do. Do they bolster their reasoning why they needed that for Voting Rights Act, why they need that for immigration issues? Every member of the Democrats on the stage this past week for the presidential debate said, we're going to give out free health care to illegal immigrants. It would sure be nice to know how big a pot of money that is we're talking about as a matter of basic budgeting and public policy. Asking a citizenship question will help that. So there are all sorts of reasons why we would have a citizenship question on there. And what I was most troubled by is that this administration didn't get the normal deference. We normally look at what they say publicly about their reasons. We don't dig through buried old computers and try and find out, did they have other motives of, well, you know, it reminds me of, did they have political motives too? You know, I'm surprised to see that there's gambling going
but
on in the back room.
Professor Eastman, isn't it true, though, that this really is a political body in the first place? And when you talk about, you know, whether this question was designed to underrepresent minorities or not, those are issues that seemingly the Supreme Court has wanted to dealt with regardless of the legal precepts that may underlie the justification for these type of issues?
Well, you know, I mean, the claim that this is going to undercut minority voting strength is speculative. And I think what we see here, there's no question knowing citizenship at the granular level, at the census tract level, will help with our Voting Rights Act litigation out of the Department of Justice. In fact, I would go further. The Supreme Court a few years ago in a case called Evenwell versus Abbott held that the states were not required to apportion only on the basis of citizens, but strongly suggested they could. And of course, apportioning based on citizenship is part of our consent to the govern foundational principle of our Republican institutions. It's right there in the Declaration of Independence. The consent of the govern, not the consent of people who happen to be visiting here, is what gives us our body politic and how we choose representatives. So all of these things are important. The notion that citizenship doesn't matter anymore, which is really what the drive here is not where we are as a country, and I hope we don't get there.
It's terrifying. Honestly, if I were to go and demand my voting rights in France, I'd be kicked out. I'd be put on the next plane. In most countries, that doesn't happen. Visitors get a say in what happens in government. I don't understand this, and I don't understand how seemingly very intelligent people are going along with this.
Well, there's been a move on the left in the legal academy and in the political science academy for a decade or so now to try and challenge the very notion of nation state sovereignty and of citizenship and of borders. That's gaining steam now and is moving into the mainstream in the political discourse. And this asking about citizenship is kind of the canary in the coal mine, if you will. This is the first step of this effort to obliterate any notion of sovereignty.
Okay, well, we've got to take a break. Before we do, really quickly, let's get the bottom line. Look into your crystal ball, Professor Eastman. Will Roberts accept another precept regarding this question if it comes back to them?
I think he will. And I think they are going to bolster this with lots of reasons instead of just one. You know, normally just one reason would have been sufficient. They're going to bolster it with a dozen reasons of why having a citizenship question is helpful to various government agencies and policies. And that should be the end of the matter.
And you may be right. And if you are, you have to wonder, why is our system working this way? Why didn't Roberts just vote the other way on this one rather than delay and cost more money? Because it's just going to cost a lot more money to bring another case regarding this issue and with a lot of other justifications, which maybe he'll adopt. Because, as you say, if he didn't say it was unconstitutional, then, I think that the writing's on the wall. We have to take a break, Professor Eastman. We got a lot to cover. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Hey. Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposures, cancers, and death. RGW lawyers are compassionate and aggressive, with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers, and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner. If you're suffering from a work-related injury, Rowan, Gervey, and Wynn lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now, 855-4-RGW-LAW, 855-4-RGW-LAW, or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Welcome back to Gervey's Law. Still thinking about what can go wrong? Instead, let's get excited about what can go right on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. We're talking to Professor John Eastman of Chapman University Law School, the Dale E. Fowler School of Law, former dean, professor there. If you want to call in and challenge Dr. Eastman, his numbers, our numbers, we're not giving his number, 800-222-5222. That's 800-222-5222. I'm Alan Gervey. I'm here with Carrie Kasem. We got a lot of ground to cover. We're talking about the Supreme Court term that just ended. And John, we're going to have to move through this pretty quickly because there's a lot of cases. We probably need a couple of hours here, but we only have another 10 or 15 minutes. So let's get to this. I want to ask you about the Maryland Peace Cross case next. That's the one where there was a 40-foot cross on public land in Maryland that was honoring fallen soldiers in World War I. And the court ruled that it doesn't violate the separation of church and state, and it can remain standing. There's a history of cases on this one. 7-2 was the count, with Ginsburg, Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, dissenting along with Sotomayor. And Justice Ginsburg talked about the Star of David, saying that that doesn't represent those who were fallen in war, because so many people don't believe in the Jewish faith. So why would the cross? And I know Kavanaugh said something about that it's equally American, and there's no matter what religion you are, or if you don't have a religion, it's an American symbol. Justice Ginsburg, a Jewish justice, took issue with that. What is your take?
Well, you know, I think they're asking the wrong questions. The cross is clearly a Christian symbol, and we ought not to denigrate it and make it sound like it's not. But it's also not an establishment of religion to have a cross that represents the overwhelming majority religion in the country. What was an establishment of religion when the time that prohibition in the First Amendment was written was compelling people to adopt a particular faith or making a condition of voting or holding office. None of that occurs here. Taking
offense. But, you know, I have to interrupt you for 1 second because I'm offended by one thing that you said, and that's about overwhelming majority. Isn't our country founded on minorities and respect and equality? When you talk about overwhelming majority, sure, whether it's Christians, whether it's Caucasians, whatever it is, there are overwhelming majorities. Does that mean that we ignore the others or we use the symbols of the overwhelming majority in the face of minorities?
Well, so one of the minorities in the country today are atheists, and yet our Declaration of Independence says that we all are created equal and that we have inalienable rights derived from our Creator. That adopts the proposition that it is accepted by the overwhelming majority, and it's the very thing that gives the minority access to rights. What the people that wanted to tear the cross down want is to take a symbol that's important to the majority and say, you don't get to have that at all because we take offense at it. Now, if I was forcing some member of the minority to bow to it, to swear allegiance to it as a condition on holding office, that's the coercion that qualifies as establishment as originally understood. And what this decision is doing is getting us back to the coercion view of establishment, not the I don't like it when I drive by, I take offense view. Which is where we've morphed into over the last couple of decades.
You know, we want to move on to the next case, but I'll just ask you this to leave on this case. If there were justices, now this was 7-2, if the justices were primarily Jewish or Muslim, and maybe there were two Christians as justices on the Supreme Court, do you think the decision would have been different?
I don't think it would have been different if they're faithfully applying the law as it comes down. If they're trying to impose their personal views, then maybe it would have come down different. But if the question is, what does the Establishment Clause prohibit? Does it prohibit? And by the way, this was not originally on public land. It was on private land that got taken over by the government. So we got to add that back to the piece here. But if it was a Star of David instead, honoring Jewish war dead from World War I, it's still not an establishment of religion, and it ought to be allowed to be upheld.
See, I agree with that. I think that anybody's religion, you should have the right to put place whatever it is, whether it's a Star of David or a cross or whatever it may be. I don't understand what I'm looking at the pictures here. It's not in, and maybe I'm looking at it differently. It seems like it's kind of out in the country. So it's not like in the middle of the city where people are, you know, if they're upset or.
Well,
by
it doesn't matter where it is.
But why? I'm just wondering, why are people so upset about
this? If it's on public property.
But there's so many religions here. And one of my favorite bumper stickers is coexist with all the different, you know, symbols of the different religions. So I think the Star of David should be allowed up if that was there.
Well, we're not going to bother with the Supreme Court decision. It will remain standing. Carrie, talk about the next case, Box versus Planned Parenthood. I know this is your favorite.
It's not my favorite. It was just very interesting to me that why would we have this? It seems going up against Planned Parenthood, it almost is like they're being attacked over and over and over again. And this one, I'm not exactly why this has been taken to the Supreme Court about the fetuses and where they go or the
disposal the proper of them. Disposal
yes.
of fetal remains.
What's going on here?
Let's ask the professor.
Please.
Yeah, so it was an interesting case, and the court kind of in a split decision granted cert, vacate, and issued a per curiam opinion on the disposal of fetal remains, and that passes a legitimate governmental purpose, passes our rational basis test, doesn't create an undue burden on the right to an abortion, and therefore the lower court decision that struck down that aspect of the Indiana law is overturned. It denied review on the more significant dispute, which is banning abortions based on sex, race, or disability selective abortions. And the court held that there's not a circuit split on that yet. We want to see the lower courts deal with that question more thoroughly. Other courts of appeals deal with it before we visit that question. So that issue remains up in the air as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. But that part of Indiana's law was struck down.
Does it give us a hint as to the bigger issue, Roe v. Wade? Do we know from how the justices voted on the fetal remains issue how that may transpire if we look at it in the future?
Well, it's a per curiam opinion, so we don't even know who authored it. Justice Thomas filed a concurring opinion, and Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. And then Sotomayor would have denied the petition in its entirety. So we've got a pretty good idea where Ginsburg and Sotomayor stand, but we had a pretty good idea before
right.
this. And we got a pretty good idea where Justice Thomas stands, but again, we had a pretty good idea before it. What we don't know is where Kavanaugh and Roberts come down on it, and that will have to wait for another chapter.
Yeah, and I don't know that we're going to know about that too soon. It seems like they're not that enthusiastic of moving on the big question, and I think Kavanaugh has made it clear in the past that he didn't think he wanted to disrupt Roe v. Wade. Would that be correct?
Well, yes, and certainly this first year, there was a case up at a preliminary stage from Louisiana that he voted to send back for further development. So there are a lot of cases heading to the Supreme Court. Whether they get there next year or the year after remains to be seen.
All right, let's move on to the Kaiser v. Wilkie case. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that? That's the courts deferring to agencies' interpretation of their own rules. A little bit complex, but maybe you can simplify it, Professor.
Well, and it's a core effort that we've been engaged in as litigators before the Supreme Court for about 15 years. So you got you know, an administrative state of unelected bureaucrats that largely run the show in Washington. It's been that way since the 1930s, and it's getting worse. And the court has augmented that delegation of lawmaking power to these unelected agencies with several administrative law deference doctrines. We won't enforce the constitutional requirement that lawmaking be done by Congress. We'll allow delegation to the agencies. And then we'll have statutes that may be ambiguous, and then we'll defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute when it passes a regulation, that's Chevron deference. And then when the agency passes its own ambiguous regulation, we'll defer to the agency when it goes back and forth.
At this point, I am so confused.
I'm not. I think there's a little sarcasm in
Nancy's nodding.
Professor Eastman's analysis.
Yeah. And here's the point. So when an agency comes in and say you have to defer to us under this doctrine called Seminole Rock or our deference, you got two people arguing in court. One says, I think the regulation means X, and the other says Y. But the guy saying it means X is from the government, and he says, but court, you have to side with us because you have to give us deference. I mean, what kind of a fair hearing is that before the court? And the Supreme Court is now seriously questioning that doctrine for the first time in decades. And although the Kaiser decision didn't overrule our outright, it got pretty close. Justice Kagan wrote the majority opinion, but she so tightened when we're going to use our deference that it was really a large victory for those that wanted to overrule it outright.
I think it's difficult for a layperson to really follow this because they don't understand necessarily administrative law and agencies versus litigation before federal courts or before state courts. So it becomes difficult to understand. Bottom line is essentially what you're saying is if these agencies are beyond the scope of the courts, what checks and balances are there?
That's right. We had agencies who are writing the laws, and then they are enforcing the law, and then through their own administrative law judges, they're adjudicating the law as well, combining all three powers of government in a single unelected agency.
There you go.
Montesquieu said that's the very definition of tyranny, and yet that's what we got. And that's why the Supreme Court is looking seriously at rolling back on these doctrines.
Right. All right. So we only have a minute or two left. A couple quick cases. Tell us what your favorite is and what's the most important. I'm just going to mention names and we can't get to all of them, but there's Gundy, the Rucho, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, R-U-C-H-O, and the Nick decision. Tell us which one's the most important.
I'm going to say Gundy because this is another, it's very arcane, but it's not very deep in the Constitution. It's Article 1, Section 1, Clause 1. The legislative powers herein granted are vested in Congress. And that means that only Congress can make laws, not delegate that lawmaking power to unelected agencies. It's the non-delegation doctrine. And Gundy challenged the non-delegation doctrine and sought to revive it. He didn't succeed, but the critical vote there is Justice Alito's. And he makes clear that as soon as we get a case when Kavanaugh is not recused, as he was from this one,
right,
there are now five votes to revive the non-delegation doctrine and start telling the Congress the only way we're going to get lawmaking is if you do it. You can't pass the buck to agencies and let them do your job for you. And that's, I think, a very significant recovery of basic separation of powers principles we have in our Constitution.
And that's an excellent point. I think that really drives it home, something that we can look forward to in the future to see how this is all going to shake out. Because if we are taking the powers away from the courts in a number of different situations, you're wondering exactly where the checks and balances are. And liberals will say it's really important when we're talking about Trump and we're talking about the presidency and how there are checks and balances on that. And then you have these situations here, which are not all encompassing like the presidency, but certainly have a huge impact on our day-to-day life and legislation, regulations. Professor Eastman, I wish we could talk to you for another 2 hours. Interesting stuff. I want to thank you so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law. Where is he?
Well, he's gone.
He had enough. He just said, you know what?
He hung up on us.
I'm just done. I had it. You're not going to tell me how the cases go. All right. Anyway, we got Chesa Boden waiting in the wings. He's ready to talk about the district attorney's office race in San Francisco, and you don't want to miss his story. Interesting stuff. You listen to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. I'm still waiting for this music to get exciting, but it doesn't seem like it will. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm here with Carrie Kasem, and we are going to welcome to the show now, after that Supreme Court overview, we're going to welcome Chase Bowden. Now, Chase Bowden has a very interesting story. He is deputy public defender in San Francisco, and he's candidate for the San Francisco District Attorney 2019 election. And he's got it. He's got a great race going on. Susie Loftus, who's been endorsed by Dianne Feinstein and Kamala Harris, Nancy Tung, Leif Deutsch. The incumbent DA, George Gaskin, is not running. So this first time, there will not be an incumbent in the race. So it's anyone's race. And Chase has had some very interesting takes on the criminal justice system. He's got a progressive criminal justice approach. And perhaps that evolved as a result of his upbringing. Very different. I'm sure the others in the race don't have the same background. Of course, they don't. Chase's parents were arrested when he was 14 months old. They were members of the radical leftist group known as the Black Liberation Army and Weather Underground. They were sentenced for their role in a general robbery that left three dead, including two police officers. His father's still in prison. Mother has been released. And he was raised by William Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, who were with the Weather Underground. Chase, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be on.
It's great to have you. Now, the obvious question we have is, you have a very specific platform that is very different from a lot of your competitors. How did it evolve through your life? You went to Yale Law School, obviously learned a lot about the criminal justice system, law in general, but you have this background. How did that impact where you are now and what your platform exists of?
Well, I didn't just start working on or thinking about these issues after law school, as most of my competitors did. You know, criminal justice reform is something I've thought about since before I could talk or walk. As you said, I grew up visiting my biological parents in prison. And while it may not be a common experience to the listener today, it's actually an experience shared with the majority of Americans. Believe it or not, more than half of Americans have an immediate family member who is either currently or formerly incarcerated. That's how widespread this problem of mass incarceration is. And for me, what that meant was that every time I wanted to see my parents as a kid, and to this day with my father, I had to go through a metal detector and steel gates. And it meant that I'd been thinking about these issues, the way they impact communities and families and victims' rights since quite literally before I could talk. And for me, the main lesson that I've learned over the years is just how profoundly dysfunctional and costly our criminal justice system is. It's not working for victims of crime. It's not keeping us safer. It's certainly not working to rehabilitate people. We have recidivism rates that are through the roof. And it's coming at a very high economic and social cost to the families caught up in it.
Is your father going to be in jail for the rest of his life or prison for the rest of his life?
That's certainly how it appears. He has a 75-year minimum sentence, and that means his first date for parole eligibility would be in 2056. That's quite a long time after. He's going to be 75 years old this year.
How do they feel about what they've done now? Do they talk to you about what happened? Did they have, along the way, have they changed their mind?
My parents have expressed remorse for what they did in conversations with me as long as I can remember. They were very clear from the beginning that they did not intend for anybody to get hurt. Neither one of my parents was armed or even at the scene of the robbery itself. They were just driving.
What? Car. Okay. So this is so interesting to me. Neither of your parents were armed. They were driving, and your dad has a 75 minimum.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So this is again, you know, we talk about mass incarceration and we talk about why it is that the United States has 25% of the world's prison population. In most countries in the world, you couldn't get a sentence longer than 25 years to life. Here, you know, my dad, who was unarmed, just driving a car, was actually sentenced to three times that.
Wow.
And the reason is we have this legal doctrine called felony murder, which is a doctrine which actually California just did away with last year, Senate Bill 1437. But it existed in New York at the time my parents were arrested there. And it's a doctrine that allows the state to punish someone essentially for first-degree premeditated murder, even if they were not on scene, uninvolved in the physical violence, unarmed, and to hold them accountable as though they had pulled the trigger. That's what happened to my dad. People got killed. He was convicted and sentenced for three first-degree murder terms, even though he was unarmed.
And there were two police officers who were killed as well. And Chase, I want to ask you, do you believe that the political perspective of your parents played a role in the sentencing? We just talked about some Supreme Court cases, and we talked about the positions of the justices, a lot of politics that seemed to bleed into decisions, whether it's with the Supreme Court or in the criminal justice system. Do you blame the political beliefs and maybe perhaps First Amendment issues on some of the criminal sentencing that goes on?
Well, to be clear, what my parents did was and would be a crime in any civilized society. Participating in an armed car robbery that leaves three men dead is and always will be a crime. But they were motivated in participating in that crime by their political views. And that does change the nature of the act. They weren't seeking to get rich or to buy drugs. They were seeking to contribute resources to a political movement that they believed in. That changes the nature of you know, who they were. And I do think it affected the length of sentence they received. Frankly, I think they probably would have received a shorter sentence had they simply been trying to get money for themselves.
You know, one of the things that you talk about is giving the crime victims a voice in every case. Is that consistent with what you're saying about your parents and their specific situation?
Absolutely. You know, obviously, in my parents' case, the three primary victims were men, two police officers, one security guard, who whose voice was silenced forever by that tragic crime. And so giving them a voice really means their next of kin in the case of murders, as in my parents' case. So I think giving their next of kin a voice is important. I think giving every survivor who is impacted directly or indirectly by crime and by the criminal justice system a voice is critical. And I think if you look at how much money we're willing to spend to punish people, in my parents' case, tens of millions of dollars between the prosecution and the incarceration, the families of the men who were killed have very little to show for all that money we've spent.
But on the one hand, when you say that it perhaps had some political implications with the sentencing, but the other, if you are giving the victims a voice, perhaps that may result in longer sentencing, not only in your parents' situation, but in situations in general. And when you're talking about mass incarceration, isn't there, and reducing it, of course, isn't there kind of a conflict there?
I don't think so, because, first of all, my dad was given the maximum sentence possible. So empowering the victims to have more of a voice in his case couldn't have possibly lengthened his sentence. He was given the statutory maximum. But more broadly, and I think more to the point, I believe in victims' rights because I think that for far too long, our criminal justice system has used victims' rights and the rhetoric of victims' rights to justify failed tough-on-crime policies. And I think that if we give victims a meaningful choice and allow them to participate in a restorative justice process, to focus resources and expertise on healing the harm that crime causes in our communities, I think victims are far better off. I think we empower them. I think we allow them to heal. We support them in that process. And we dramatically reduce the recidivism rates that we know across the country are above two-thirds.
Yes, I think that those are some interesting points. I want to talk a little bit about diverting mentally ill and drug addicted offenders from prison, because a lot of people have a lot to say on it. We have to take a break, though. We're talking to Chase Bowden. He is a candidate for the San Francisco District Attorney Office, which will take place in November 2019, coming up. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yeah, we're back. We're talking to Chase Bowden, who is a candidate for San Francisco District Attorney, 2019 election, and he is a deputy public defender in San Francisco. He has a very interesting platform. One of the things, and we'll talk about it in a moment, Chase, is you talk about being tough on police misconduct. It's a hot button issue for a lot of people in this country. Before we talk about that, before the break, I teased about your plans of diverting mentally ill and drug addicted offenders from prison somewhere else. And I think a lot, you get a lot of support from people with that thought. But the question is, how do you do it and where do you put these offenders?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And I think if we want to make our communities safer, which of course we do, and that's why I'm running for district attorney, then you have to look at the root causes of crime. In San Francisco, 85% of bookings into county jail are a person who's severely drug addicted, mentally ill, or both. That's an overwhelming majority of people whose crime or involvement with the police is caused at least in part by their addiction or their illness. And so if we don't factor that into how we hold them accountable, if we don't make treatment and engagement with services a required part of any punishment, then when they get released, they're going to go back out and do the same thing. And that's why we have recidivism rates that are so high. In fact, in San Francisco, we have a recidivism rate of above 100%.
Oh, wow. I didn't know it could go above 100%.
I've never heard of that before. What about the man who was arrested 70 times for being a pervert and groping women on the subway in New York? I mean, the guy keeps getting let out. It seems like, you know, the problem is my friend a few weeks ago got beaten up by a homeless man. So what do you do, you know, with people like that? How do don't you want to keep them in jail?
Well, I think it really depends on the context. I mean, absolutely, the cases you're describing, if somebody's a pervert who's groping people dozens of times, I think
70 times.
It seems like they would be prosecuted for that and made to register as a sex offender under California law.
He is. And they keep letting him out. So the police finally said, we have to change the law to keep this guy in, which is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, it's unusual to hear in this day and age people calling for longer prison sentences. The United States already leads the world in locking people up, has by far the most people per capita and as a percentage serving prison terms, and it's already 10% of the state budget. You know, I think the question is, are we getting a good return on our investment? You know, we're spending more than $20 billion a year in California just on our prison system. That doesn't include county jail, local police, courthouses. Are we getting a good return? Is it making us safer? And the answer is it's not. The current approach is failed. It's been failed. It's devastating communities. It's devastating taxpayers. And it's leaving police, as you say, often without the tools they need to keep us safe.
So what about mental health treatment? Because you have to be able to look at an alternative. It's easy to say it's not working. What do we do with these people who, like you say, a lot of them are either heavily drug addicted or mentally ill? What do we do with them? Where's the mental health treatment?
Sure. Well, we definitely need to invest more money in mental health treatment. It's certainly more cost effective, has better long-term outcomes for individuals, and is also a more humane way to treat people who are ill. California just passed a new law about a year ago, which created a mental health diversion program. Now, it's not funded. It's up to each county or each individual case to find the treatment that's needed. But the law allows for judges to dismiss criminal charges if someone whose crime was motivated by their mental illness engages successfully in treatment for 2 years. That's the kind of progress we need to incentivize people and their lawyers and their families and support networks to get them engaged with services on medication so they don't commit a crime again.
All right, so we're going to switch gears really quickly. Police shooting investigations. It seems that under DA George Gaskin, they've taken years and sometimes have gone nowhere. What is your plan and how do you really address the police misconduct?
You know, the police are not above the law. And we all depend on honest, hardworking police to serve and protect us. We need them. We respect them. But we also know that, as with any other group, there are some police officers who do not follow the law, who lie, who falsify reports or evidence, who steal, and in some cases even kill. Now, that is not the majority of officers, but when it happens, even if it's rare, it's essential that we have an independent district attorney who's willing to stand up for the rights of the people and enforce the law equally. If we don't enforce the law equally, and if we allow those bad apples to get away with it, to get away with murder in some cases, what it does is it undermines the integrity of the entire criminal justice system. It erodes the trust that communities have in the police, and it means people are not willing to come forward and report crimes, cooperate right. with the police, testify in court. We are all less safe as a result.
What about cash bail? Why is it unconstitutional? Really quickly.
I've been leading the fight against cash bail because it's discriminatory. It's discriminatory for the following reason. You take a rich person and a poor person, they do exactly the same thing. They have present exactly the same public safety risk. The rich person can buy their way out immediately. Mm-hmm. The poor person languishes behind bars until they waive their right to trial and plead guilty. Now, the rich person may even be more dangerous. You could be accused of attempted murder and have the money to bail out and go finish the job, whereas you could be accused of shoplifting and have no money and stay in jail for months while you lose your job, lose your home, lose custody of your kids. It's very destructive, it's very discriminatory, and it makes us less safe. That's why I've led the fight for the last 5 years in San Francisco and across the state to get the courts to declare the use of money bail unconstitutional.
And why haven't they?
Well, they have, in fact. The California Court of Appeal, the First District Court of Appeal, ruled in a very powerful and well-written opinion by Justice Klein, the longest-serving justice in the currently active on the California Court of Appeal, that the way money bail was being used in San Francisco was unconstitutional. That opinion is now being reviewed by the California Supreme Court, and so is not taking effect until the Supreme Court gets the last word.
Any predictions?
I think we're going to win in the sense that I think it's really not controversial at this point to say that using bail to effectively detain someone who is otherwise not eligible to be detained, presumed innocent,
right.
Is unconstitutional. The question is who qualifies, who's eligible for pretrial detention. And I think the devil will be in the details with regard to the court opinion. I mean, we know the court will say that there are categories of people who are too low risk,
yeah.
too limited criminal history to be detained using a monetary payment. The question is, where does the court draw the line?
Right. Let's just talk for a minute here before we let you go. The election. Who do you see as your biggest competition? Is it Susie Loftus? And how will you win this election?
I think Susie Loftus is the biggest competition, and I'm going to win this election the way that progressive candidates win elections, which is hard work, grassroots energy and mobilization, and by having better ideas and connecting with more voters. You know, we have a campaign that is tremendously energized by the national movement to rethink the approach to criminal justice that has elected a wave of progressive prosecutors from coast to coast. We are part of that movement. We're drawing on the energy and the ideas of that movement. And in San Francisco, we have hundreds of volunteers who come out to our events, who get the work done, who go and talk with voters door to door, phone banking, dropping off literature at bus stations in the morning during morning commute. We are out there every day working hard to make sure San Franciscans know about us and know that we are committed to making San Francisco safer for everybody, to enforcing the law equally, and to finding smart on crime, innovative approaches to reduce the recidivism rates that are plaguing our city and our country.
Chase, in just a couple of words, what's the biggest difference between you and Susie, other than the connections that she may have?
Well, I've led the fight against money bail. I speak fluent Spanish. I've grown up visiting my family members in prison and understand what it means to separate a child from their parents because of crime. And I'm the only candidate in this race who currently works in San Francisco's criminal courts. So I've got far more experience in the courtrooms actually over the last 7 or 8 years than all the other candidates combined in the race.
Chase, thanks so much for joining Gervie's Law today. We wish you all the luck in the world and continue on with this path of justice.
Thanks so much for having me. I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Sounds great. All right. Well, that's going to do it for our show today. Carrie?
Yes.
You survived.
We did it.
You survived.
We did it.
We did it.
We did it.
Your favorite show. We'll We'll continue with the fluff next week. We got some fluff topics, and we'll enjoy the week. I'm just kidding. I love this show.
Lord. Listen, I like when we do law shows. I learn.
All right. We got to go. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.